now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time, and welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always, always been in you. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And I just wanted to just make you aware of it, that these broadcasts are now podcasted in case you want to go back to listen again, or if you want to go back into the archives and listen to previous shows, and just invite you to do that. You can just go back in through the website and you'll just find the link for that. And I just wanted to thank you all again for your support over the past year, and I'd like to say that you now have an opportunity to continue your support by becoming a monthly subscriber. Now, just a little caveat here, a monthly subscription is not required to listen to my talk shows. It doesn't like unlock a vault or anything, but the subscription is greatly appreciated. So again, you can just go to the website and click on that link and choose any amount you feel comfortable giving. Okay, and again, thank you for that. Well, I am very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, because each and every week these broadcasts are dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And if you want to call in to be part of the live show, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. And for anybody who's tuning in for the first time, I just wanted to say thank you. Always enjoy first-time listeners. And I just wanted to share a little bit of background in case you're wondering what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about. In a sense, it's in this kind of a nutshell here, that it really doesn't matter, who we are or where we were born or into what family we were placed. Ours is a world that is just full of relationships, and indeed we are social beings who often spend their lives trying to make sense of our world by trying to find our place in the world, okay? And as social beings, it's often within the context of these relationships that we experience tremendous pain and suffering. Okay, from overt acts of betrayal and cruelty that somebody has inflicted against us, or vice versa, to simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time, many, many people bear the scars of the physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual woundedness. And yet, one of life's greatest ironies is that just as we experience our woundedness in the context of relationships, it's also within the context of healthier relationships that we can find our greatest source of healing, our voice, our authenticity. Now, the difficulty then is often finding the courage to discover that which has always been in you, hence reclaiming authenticity. Okay. And when we look deep within ourselves, we often discover those things that have always been within us, such as our gifts or our graces, our skills, our uniqueness that we come into the world with. And I am a firm believer that we come into this world with everything that we need for ourselves and others, from day one. you know, that we take a breath into this world. We come into the world with the very, very best of who we are. But it's often through various experiences that we've, you know, sometimes give away those parts, if not the whole, of that uniqueness or that this-ness, you know, what's special about us and what's special in us. And perhaps we, you know, we do this because we didn't feel as though we could live up to another person's expectations of us. Or perhaps maybe we hid that uniqueness from others in order to survive various kinds of abuse. Or perhaps those aspects of ourselves have been taken away from us and we didn't have the strength to fight back. Well, either way, when we become aware that we have done these things, it does take tremendous courage to reclaim who we are. But we certainly can reclaim our voice, our uniqueness, our authenticity. And this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. And it focuses on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, all within this backdrop of our relationships. The relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with others, and certainly the relationship that we have with God or the divine. Okay? So, it's just interesting. The whole reason why I place this integration in relationships is because, as I said, this is the backdrop of everything in our lives. It always comes back to relationships, okay? And the relationships just might be within our own families. You know, how many times have we fought amongst family members at birthdays or other celebrations, or, you know, as we're coming now into mid-September or start of fall, I should say, getting close to the holidays, yeah, that brings out the worst and best in people. So, you know, these relationships just might be within our own families or coworkers, you know, our colleagues or even our friends. However, we're not without hope. Because whenever we transform and we improve in our lives and we find our healing, we're also going to transform others by our presence, our grace, and understanding. Because we're going to see things differently. We're going to treat people differently. But first and foremost, that forgiveness and kindness and compassion has to begin with how we treat ourselves. Because whenever we are compassionate with ourselves, we then can be more compassionate with others. And whenever we are more forgiving with ourselves, we then can be more forgiving with others. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this truly opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. Well, how is your heart today? I hope your heart is well. I hope you are well. And I hope that if for any particular reason, if you are struggling today, that you will be able to find the rest, the comfort, and the peace that you need. Well, this is a particularly special broadcast since September is Suicide Prevention Month. And I wanted to take this opportunity to talk about just the different nuances that are tied up into how do we move forward after a loved one has taken their life. You know, so I wanted to talk about the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual needs that families long to have met as they continue to struggle with coming to terms with a loved one who has died, or even one who currently has suicide ideation. So at the beginning of this broadcast, I wanted to provide you two resources that you could use or even pass along to others who are in need. The first one being the National Suicide Hotline. This is available 24 hours, 7 days a week. You know, I mean, it never closes. So the number to the National Suicide Hotline is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. And then there's also the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I'm sorry, I'm getting tongue-tied here. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. There we go. And on this particular website, you can find information to find different support groups throughout the United States, wherever you are located, whatever state that you're living in, and then it gets very specific into locations according to city and so forth. That website is AF, as in Fox, SP. So American Foundation Suicide Prevention .org. Okay. So, like I said, you either if you have the need for those resources, great. If you know somebody who can benefit from those resources, by all means, please, please pass that information along to them. Okay. So, just a quick word, and I kind of hesitate on using that phrase, a quick word, because it's, you know, nothing's really quick when we're talking about matters such as, you know, the depth and the uncomfortableness of suicide. But I just wanted to state that before we get into the matter of suicide, I feel like I need to say something about the stigma that is imposed on others by society. Okay, this is often a heavy, unnecessary weight upon weight upon weight, as in, you know, W-E-I-G-H-T, that, you know, it's just put upon people unnecessarily. Okay, and although we've come a long way over the decades and decades in society, there is still a tremendous amount of stigma shown to people who struggle with a mental illness. You know, from what's being depicted on TVs and movies to stories that are shared among family members, stigma, you know, or stigmas are still the marks that others bear in silence. Okay. And again, we can go back even further. We can go back as far as you want to go, because whether it was leprosy in, let's say, early biblical times, or tuberculosis in ancient Greece, or the bubonic plague in the Middle Ages, or the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, otherwise known as AIDS, in the late 20th century. And now that we're in the 21st century, we certainly have our fair share of diseases and illnesses and types of death that are uncomfortable to others. But in spite of the historical patterns that are going on, societies have displayed just this pattern of purposefully disenfranchising people who have contracted such diseases, or let's say who have also taken their own lives by suicide. And initially, it was always justified, this kind of reaction down through history was justified as necessary to prevent a further spread of either, say, a communicable disease, or again, we were uncomfortable with this, so we'd have to quickly get it out or get it away or something, or have people move away. But yet, many people who are afflicted interpreted being, shall we say, quarantined as society's way of displaying contempt for the sick and the wounded. And as a result, many people felt stigmatized by their illnesses, or they felt shunned or alienated from fully participating in their communities of persons or as persons of value and worth. And this is certainly true when we start to take a look at the history of suicide. And this expulsion, shall we say, from society was true not only for people who had a so-called identifiable, unacceptable physical condition, but it was also for those who had a condition that was not readily seen, such as mental illness. Now, ironically, it was actually the Greeks who originated the term stigma to refer to bodily signs, you know, designed to expose something unusual or negative about the moral status of the one who bears that sign. And these signs, which again were imposed by society, were either cut or burned into a person's body, which then advertise his or her condition, you know, such whether or not that they were a slave or a criminal or a traitor or whatever Okay, but they were, in a sense, it was in a place that couldn't be hidden. And so as a result, this act of branding, so to speak, signified to all that the recipient was a blemished person, or they were, let's say, ritually polluted. And because they were blemished, they needed to be avoided, especially in public places. And such markings or such brandings not only spoiled a person's social identity, but it also cut off that person from society and thus forcing him or her to live in isolation in a very unaccepting world. And from this aspect, it appeared as though there was no way to remove this outward sign, let alone recover from the emotional wounding from such harsh treatment. And while not always spoken, society clearly distinguishes between people that the like so-called clean versus unclean people, or the acceptable people versus unacceptable, or the lovable people versus the unlovable people. And within disenfranchised grief, people living with either suicide ideation or as well as family members struggling to make sense of a loved one who has taken their own lives, society's stigma is more than likely going to be transferred to the surviving loved ones. And this is something that I had seen clearly, not only within my own studies, but I've seen it with my own eyes. I don't know why this happens. It's almost like a guilt by association. Okay. And despite its unpopularity, it is crucial. It's even more crucial today to give voice to people who feel that they have been disenfranchised through whatever, death that they are grieving, or mental health, or an illness, or whatever it is. All the more reason to give voice to the people who feel disenfranchised and to embrace them as persons of value and worth. And for this show, I just, again, wanted to begin with just a simple definition of just what exactly is suicide, and just how do we capture, the context of what are we talking about here. So I see and I understand suicide as a result of a person's perception that life is so unbearable that a self-inflicted death is the only escape from his or her physical and or emotional pain. Okay. And other researchers, they expand this, definition of suicide to include conscious acts from a person whose situation is such that he or she no longer wishes to continue in it. And as a result, this type of death profoundly affects family members and friends of persons who have found this solutions that their loved ones was, they had perceived that that was the only alternative left for them. Now, the taking of one's own life may result from just a variety of influences. There's never one single solitary factor involved. Okay. And just to name a few here, a person may be struggling with severe depression or severe schizophrenia, or struggling to maintain their sobriety from, let's say, a substance abuse or substance dependence, or chronic or a terminal illness, or a personality disorder or anxiety disorders, like I said, to name a few. Now, the surviving family members, the surviving loved ones, are not only left with just a tremendous sense of shock and disbelief when they discover that their loved one had committed suicide, but they also really struggle with intensified feelings of loss or blame, or fear, or shame, or rejection, or anger, or guilt, and many, many other unanswered questions. And while anger is a normal response to any type of loss, Suicide survivors have an intensified anger that's often directed at the deceased, or it could be directed at the mental health system, or even at themselves for not recognizing the signs or for not being able to, shall we say, rescue or protect the deceased. Now, perhaps what's most troublesome for many people about suicide is the moral issue that's involved. You know, that is the belief that human beings do not have the right to hasten their own deaths. And one researcher is Rees, R-E-E-S. He affirms that life is sacred and suicide is a self-destructive act disrupting the natural order of living and dying, something many people believe is reserved only for God. And furthermore, you know, when a suicide occurs, survivors are often left with bearing this reproach again from society. In fact, to understand fully the intensity of the grief reaction or even the process of mourning a suicide, a member who has committed suicide, one really has to go all the way back to how society has treated suicides. You know, what was just the historical patterns there and where did this stigma originally come from? Okay, so let's go back here and, you know, just look at some cultural attitudes towards the subject of suicide and just how surviving family members have been treated throughout time. Okay, so just for example, in the 18th century Europe, okay, the 1700s, the suicide victim's body, for lack of a better phrase, was often dragged through the streets. Some bodies were decapitated or thrown to wild animals or even hung upside down. And the body was denied a proper burial or would be placed in a sewer or brought to the side of the road with a stake driven through the heart and covered with stones. And in addition, you know, surviving family members were forced to leave their homes without any goods or property. They just had to leave. They had to get out of town because, again, this stigma was being transferred over to them. And even to go a little bit further, that, you know, any kind of property or title or the goods of the deceased would all be then forfeited to the king. And then a law or, you know, some decree that there would be no memory of the person's suicide. Okay. And there are often some trials that were held posthumously to determine whether the victim was insane. And therefore, well, if they were insane, then they were innocent of their death. And in such findings, it proved the deceased innocent, survivors would shoulder less blame and punishment. However, with that verdict, the survivors would still be burdened with shame and social stigma of their family member being, quote unquote, insane. Okay. And even in the 19th century, the 1800s, there was, you know, suicide was believed to be the cause by or caused by genetic influences. But by the time of the 20th century, the 1900s, this genetic influence theory was pretty much dismissed. Okay. But today in Western societies, suicide is considered a very complex phenomenon, which is associated with the psychological, biological, and social factors. Okay. And to this end, the researcher, Ken Pargament, he cautions society not to view suicide as a single impulsive act of destruction. In fact, as impulsive as a suicide may seem, people may be the most vulnerable when their deepest values are touched by events for which they have the fewest resources, but also carry the heaviest burdens. And let me say that again, because this is an important piece to fully understand, okay? Suicide is not a single impulsive act of destruction. And as impulsive as suicide may seem, people may be most vulnerable when their deepest values are touched by the events for which they have the fewest resources and the heaviest burdens. Okay, and this is truly key to not only understanding why people attempt suicide or commit suicide, but yet it also gives insight as to, you know, how do we deal with, how do we reach out, how do we either minister to, or how do we provide comfort to families whose loved ones had committed suicide, instead of allowing, let's say, society that doesn't quite get it to just continue moving that stigma over to families and act as if, well, it came from the family, the family's to blame, or whatever it is. Okay. And despite, you know, advances in understanding and this complexity of suicide, that social stigma, you know, remains an ongoing burden for surviving family members. And Toynbee, I think he had written an article, this is going way back, like I think it's 1969, 1970, which stands true today. And he states that there are always two parties involved in the pain and suffering that suicide inflicts. One, the surviving family members, who always suffer more stigma from society. And two, the person who had committed suicide. Okay, so two parties are involved in the pain and suffering in a suicide. The person who has attempted suicide or completed the suicide, and surviving loved ones or surviving family members because of this stigma. And as a result, again, down through history, you know, suicide often became the family secret. You know, it's just like, no, we're not going to tell anybody because we do not feel safe sharing this. So it often became the family secret, or maybe it was the neighbor's gossip, or some sort of source of public blame or shunning. And surviving family members, you know, just may attempt to conceal the suicide, you know, haste, you know, in just great haste, arranging funerals and seeking to keep the truth from children. Okay, and I have I've experienced this personally. I have seen where, like during funerals and so forth, that everybody in the congregation or in the memorial service, they knew it was a suicide and still wanted to remember the loved one, but no mention of suicide, you know, was permitted out of the sake, you know, for the sake of the children. They certainly wouldn't understand. And yet, by not giving voice to suicide, that also, you know, tells me that surviving family members have to withhold their own grief. You know, they have to hide because there is still this sense of shame from, well, what are people going to think if we start talking about this? And this might be too much for the kids. But really, it, you know, when we come right down to it, it tended to be too much for the family. Okay. So as a result, you know, again, down through history, survivors were kind of doomed, shall we say, to their own private shame, or they were trapped with their feelings of hurt and loss and anger. You know, and just the mourning rituals themselves for surviving family members were often compromised. They were often not permitted, just, you know, by a lack of social support, even within their own faith community. You know, and for example, within some faith communities, some clergy have refused to participate in the common burial practice within a particular religious affiliation or denomination. In fact, some may even deny burial in a church-owned cemetery. But again, this is just one layer, and, you know, just continuing on that, you know, there's many other layers of this we have to consider that the family goes through, you know, such as witnessing the suicide or finding the body of a loved one, you know, the continuing image of death or the pictures of the remains, you know, may likely result in family members, you know, having their own PTSD reaction. And certainly one aspect of suicide that profoundly exacerbates the grief reaction for surviving families is that many suicides often occur in the home. And this, again, adds additional layers because the physical remains of the suicide still may be present, you know, and it does require the family to clean up. There might be blood on the floor or bone fragments. And this is all in addition to, well, how then do we plan a funeral, or how then do we plan a memorial service? And this could be just very overwhelming in and of itself. Okay. And Van Dagen, back in 1991, he found that 11% of the people that he was working with reported having PTSD symptoms after discovering, you know, their loved one's body who had committed suicide. And the surviving loved ones often report feeling totally exhausted and unable to resume their daily routines. And, you know, even of not being a witness or discovering the body, the death of their loved one remains a traumatic event for surviving family members, because they're certainly faced with the shock of it, but also there might be police investigations that contribute to the pain as the death is explored. And again, society places some of the blame for the suicide on the family members, and thus offering even less social support than it would for survivors of, let's say, you know, natural death or natural causes. And they may feel, you know, totally alienated from friends and acquaintances because of this blame, rejection, and lack of understanding on the part of society. Now, the researchers, Calhoun and Allen, they discovered that surviving family members tend to be more psychologically disturbed or less trusting and more blameworthy than members, family members grieving non-suicidal deaths. Okay. But in order to cope, family members may even refuse to discuss the death with friends or coworkers, or may try to recreate the events, you know, in their minds that led up to the death. That if only we could go back, if only we could just stop time and take a step back, what was going on in the morning leading up to their suicide, or even the day before? And this is completely natural. This is normal that surviving loved ones do. And another researcher noted that widows whose spouses committed suicide, they reported just being less forthcoming with those who are around them. They felt the need to shut down. They felt the need to be guarded. And in addition, they also reported receiving more blame and guilt from people around them than did widows grieving a non-suicidal death. So many, many layers to not only understanding why a person would commit suicide or attempt suicide, but also how this leaves family members. Okay. Well, I would really love to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So again, if you'd like to call in and be part of the show, that number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I am Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And as we were talking about suicide and its impact on family members, I wanted to give you two resources. Again, once I did at the beginning of the broadcast, and I want to do it at the second half of the show, two resources that you could use or pass along to others who are in need. And the first one is the National Suicide Hotline. That number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. The second resource is from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And this is, you go on this website, the AFSP.org. Oh, the American Foundation Suicide Prevention website, if you are in need of support groups. And this helps you find a support groups that are available in your state and or city. Okay? When halfway through the journey of our life, I found that I was in a gloomy wood because the path which led aright was lost. And how hard it is to say just what this wild and rough and stubborn woodland was, the very thought of which renews my fear. So bitter 'tis that death is little worse, but of the good to treat, which there I found, I'll speak of what else I discovered there. I therefore think and judge it is best for thee to follow me, and I shall be your guide and lead thee hence through an eternal place where thou shalt hear the shrieks of hopelessness of those tormented spirits of old times, each one of whom bewails the second death. Then those shall you behold who, though in fire, contented are, because they come with hope, wherever it be, unto the blessed folk to whom. Thereafter, if thou wouldst ascend here, there'll be for a worthier soul than I. Well, this is actually the opening scene in Dante's Inferno. It was written, 1200s, 1300s, goes back a long time. But the Inferno, as it's called, follows the wandering of the poet Dante as he strays off the path of moral truth, and he gets lost in this dark wood. And as the story goes, just as three wild animals threaten to attack him, Dante is rescued by Virgil, a man, a celebrated Roman poet, and is also Dante's idol. And when asked why he came at this time, Virgil says that he felt sorry for Dante, and he is an appropriate guide because he has walked this way before. And I'm certain we all have appreciated being comforted by one or a community who has walked the paths before us, such as losing a loved one to suicide. And just as we need to follow the breadcrumbs, so to speak, of another person who has been there and back, we also need to pay attention and listen to what those breadcrumbs are telling us. And in different studies with bereavement of suicide survivors, there are actually four unique reactions in this group of people, which when we understand these things, it certainly sheds light on, well, this is the best way to reach out, because the more we know, hopefully, the more empathic we become. And so when the death, you know, again, suicide context here, when the death is a family member, the survivors experience very strong feelings of guilt and anger, a sense of hopelessness, a loss of social support, and actually an increase in self-destructive behaviors. In other words, you just don't care anymore. You just like, well, what's the point? Because, you know, or let's say a good example of this could be where we get in the car and we usually put on a seatbelt. Hopefully you do. But it's just a matter of like, so what if I'm in an accident? I don't really care. I mean, it's that kind of self-destructive ideation, that behavior. Okay. The next thing is that when the cause of death is perceived as unnatural or avoidable, survivors often report strong feelings of being stigmatized. Okay. And often accompanied, you know, with the perceptions of everybody left me. I feel abandoned. I feel shame. What do I do with this? And as in the case of other deaths that are unanticipated, shall we say, the survivors of suicide often report feelings of shock and searching for an explanation of the death, or feelings of blame and responsibility as even having caused the death. In addition, you know, to the trauma of dealing with the suicidal nature of the death, survivors report, you know, having these intense feelings of rejection from the deceased. Whether or not it was true, they have these intense feelings of rejection. Okay. And again, this is to hopefully create awareness in us. So as we begin to reach out, we just kind of leave all those preconceived notions at the door and just be with the person. You know, and when we approach a person whose loved one has committed a suicide, now's not the time for explanations. Now is not the time to say, well, you know, and try to offer something like that. That is the worst thing, and I mean the worst thing that we can do, because there are enough question marks hanging over everybody's head. It would be so much better if we could just sit there and hold the space for the person or persons to just be with them in their pain without feeling the need to explain it away, and let them, you know, just grieve as they need to grieve, and to be there and to be supportive. Okay. So a very strong social support is what is needed all throughout this. And surviving family members, you know, those who have strong religious and or spiritual beliefs, they may have mixed emotions, again, regarding how scripture addresses a person taking his or her own life. Now, they might even say the thing like, well, what does the Bible say? Does that mean my loved one's in hell right now? Or, you know, just like, you know, is God mad at them, or any other, you know, reactive type question? Okay. And again, you know, although the working definition that I'm using here of suicide that involves a person's perception that life is so unbearable that a self-inflicted death is the only escape from his or her physical and or emotional pain, it can also be noted that suicide hasn't always been viewed in a negative light. Okay, again, we're taking this into a different context here, but sometimes suicide can be viewed as honorable, so as in the case when a soldier will throw himself or herself on a grenade to save the other soldiers or other people around them. Okay, but another misunderstanding about suicide is that it is often just a very selfish, unthinkable act, designed, you know, only for a person to gratify himself or herself and just cause more pain and suffering for those around them. In other words, well, you'll see when I'm gone, you'll feel bad when I'm gone, you know, and I can't wait till you realize how much you miss me. That kind of spiteful behavior, okay? And as a result, there is going to be a wide range of thoughts or feelings and actions that are present when a suicide has happened, which leads many people to ask the question, is suicide unforgivable? Okay, is suicide unforgivable? Because for many years, the conventional thought in Catholic and Protestant churches is that suicide is the unforgivable sin. And, you know, Augustine argued in the 5th century that suicide was a violation of the 6th commandment, you know, you shall not murder. But later, Thomas Aquinas, who was a major Catholic thinker, believing that confession of sin must be made prior to one's death, he taught that suicide was the most fatal of all sins because the victim had no way of repenting from it. And so therefore, he presumed that if a person dies while they are committing a sinful act, they are unable to then confess that sin and ask for forgiveness. So as I said, you know, he just believed that if a person committed suicide, there's no way to repent from that. But yet, up until that time of Augustine, you know, in antiquity, generally considered suicide as a form of voluntary martyrdom and clearly distinguished it from murder. Yet, beginning with Augustine, you know, suicide became identified as murder, and more specifically, self-murder. And yet, ironically, when you go back through history, Augustine's case against suicide was not based on the Bible. It wasn't based on any other scripture, but it was actually based on Plato's writings of Socrates. And the suicide is mentioned in his work, Phaedo. P-H-A-E-D-O, Phaedo. And in this story, you know, while Socrates welcomed, you know, his own death sentence by willingly drinking hemlock, Plato argued that to sever the bonds between the body and the soul prematurely is to basically usurp a privilege which belonged only to God. But still, Socrates believed that by willfully committing suicide by drinking hemlock, he would be released from a world of pain and suffering into a place of peace. Okay? So, again, you know, there are just wide, you know, opinions on whether or not a suicide could be forgivable, or is it unforgivable. And even in the context of people who are struggling with a terminal illness, you know, a terminal illness and suicide actually go hand in hand, okay? Because although in you know, our culture and as well as other cultures, the physician-assisted suicide is an intense debate. You know, is this moral? Shouldn't you be maintaining the sanctity of life? Or are we just in the business of relieving a person of their suffering and misery? Okay, and for the most part, studies have shown that people living with a terminal illness contemplate hastening their deaths, especially when they reach a level of depression and pain in the process of dying. Okay, so as I mentioned before in the first half of the show, this mark of, you know, marginalization, this stigma, can extend even beyond a death, you know, even to those who mourn the death of a loved one from a stigmatized kind of death, such as suicide. Okay, and because of this guilt by association, just simply because I loved the person or I was related to the person, you know, survivors feel as though they cannot express their grief openly, but, you know, they may be forced to hide their feelings. And of course, that just worsens the painful process of mourning. Okay. And it almost presents or places people in, you know, almost like a double bind here in terms of their bereavement. Because while most people who mourn the loss of a loved one are free to experience normal grief reactions, others whose loved ones carry a social stigma, or the type of death carries a social stigma, they're not necessarily given the right, the role, or the capacity to grieve as others may. And to add to this, again, as I mentioned, these mourners are given little to no social support, even religious support, to help facilitate their grief. Okay? And all too often, you know, people who have experienced loss and grief and mourning and bereavement go through life in search of healing and grace. This is normal. This is what's expected. But instead of feeling drawn to communities of faith, many people, again, feel alienated by their wounds and ashamed of their scars, for lack of a better word. And as they may stare at the "all are welcome" signs that hang over the entrances of various places of worship, they know that acceptance comes with conditions. You know, perhaps conditions of appropriate circumstances or appropriate relationships or appropriate status. And again, this is a part that really baffles me because, you know, communities of faith wonder why they keep seeing a decrease in their membership and weekly attendance, you know, but yet doing the same things over and over again and they expect different results. You and I both know that is insanity. But, you know, perhaps the answers lie in the way that communities of faith and societies treat their wounded. And why is it, you know, metaphorically speaking, why do faith communities, why do certain members of society or culture or whoever, why, you know, what is the justification of, shall we say, shooting our wounded? You know, a person is already grieving, the person is already wounded, and who are we to come along to heap even more misery on them because of, let's say, we're uncomfortable with it, or because we don't want to look at it, or per se, we don't want to deal with it. Like, take it somewhere else. And so it's just, you know, metaphorically, we heap even more devastation on a person. And then we wonder why they call off sick more from work, or we wonder why their productivity goes down at work, or we wonder why they've packed up and left. Well, we have to look squarely at ourselves and just ask the question, what did we do? What did we say to make them feel this way? And then what are some things that we can do? What are some things that we can say to help them through this? Because quite honestly, this could happen to any one of us, any one of us. Okay. And from a pastoral approach here, you know, communities of faith should awaken to the fact that they are most effective when they care for the wounded and the scarred souls of society. And in doing so, people are transformed when they experience that tangible holiness through a very simple yet powerful act of redemption. Let me say that again. Communities of faith should awaken to the fact that they are most effective when they care for the wounded and the scarred souls of society. For when they do this, people are transformed whenever they experience that tangible holiness through just a very simple yet powerful act of redemption. Feeding one, clothing them, understanding, loving them, and so forth. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Good Will Hunting. It's classic. Robin Williams, he plays a psychologist, and he explains to Matt Damon's character that everybody has those little idiosyncrasies that at first glance drive us crazy. But in reality, those features contain, as he said, the good stuff. And Robin Williams' character goes on to give an example that his wife used to expel gas in the middle of the night. And she said it was so loud, she would often wake herself up, but then blame him for the unpleasant odor. And again, he said, well, I was embarrassed for it, but I just went along with it. And I just chalked it all up to the intimacy and the weirdness that they shared. But strange, you know, but as he put it, he felt honored to be able to see, hear, and yes, even smell that side of her, because nobody else would be privileged to that. And then he says, and just when I thought that it couldn't get any weirder, Williams explains, you know, it's been 2 years since Nancy died, and that's the stuff I remember. But he wasn't bitter because he realized those memories were some of the things that nobody else saw. And instead, he cherished those things because they were the things that made her his wife. And I'm convinced that there are things our loved ones did or said or do or whatever that irritate us and drove us crazy, even at times, got on our last nerve. And these are the things that we are going to miss when they're gone. But just like in Good Will Hunting, these are the memories we will relish and cherish because they are gems. They're what made our spouses our spouses. They're what made our mothers and fathers our mothers and fathers. Grandparents, siblings, coworkers, friends, all have left their impression on us. And you know, since the day when I first held my son in my arms, I kept a jar of broken glass on my desk. And every now and again, I pick it up just to hold it, to look at it, and to listen to it. And I shake it, and I just listen. And holding this jar always reminds me of two things: our brokenness and God's wholeness. Because whenever I look at it closely, I notice the sharp-edged fragments of a once whole vase. I listen carefully to the shards as they kind of clang about when I shake the jar. And I'm often reminded of the disillusionment of many people when they ask the very sincere questions, will I ever be made whole again? There are so many fragmented pieces of my life. I'm shattered spiritually, mentally, physically, emotionally, as I stand before God bearing the scars of my wounds. How will I ever be put back together again? Well, there was an emperor of Japan who possessed a very old and very costly vase. You know, it was a unique masterpiece in the art of chinaware. And one day somebody knocked it down and by accident broke it into 1,000 pieces. And these fragments were carefully collected, and the most skilled master potter of the whole empire was commissioned to put the vase together. But he tried, and then one tried after another and another and another. But in the end, only a single artist was left, an old Zen monk living with his young pupil in a cave in the mountains. And on the emperor's call, he came to the palace and he took the broken pieces with him and carried them to his humble workshop. And then he set to work. And after several weeks, the monks showed the result of his endeavor to the pupil. And the vase had resurrected in its flawless beauty. And the two monks wandered back to the city and delivered the vase to the palace. And the emperor was just overjoyed. He just couldn't believe it. And the entire palace just praised the perfection of the restored masterpiece. And of course, this old monk was richly rewarded and then gracefully dismissed. Well, one day, the young pupil was just rummaging around for something in the workshop when he unexpectedly discovered the broken scraps of the old vase. And he quickly ran to his master and he exclaimed, "Look at these pieces. Not at all did you put them back together. However, did you only manage to create a vase that is as beautiful as the shattered one?" And the old monk replied, "Well, if you put yourself to work with a heart full of love, you will always be able to create something beautiful." See, many times we look at our brokenness and shattered pieces from our emotional, physical, psychological, even spiritual wounds, and we wonder, how are they going to go back together? And in those moments, individuals and families who have walked that path before us tell us to come and follow, broken pieces and all, and piece by piece, our lives can be reassembled. Not in the way that is, let's say, familiar to us, but perhaps into a vessel that is ironically stronger in the cracks. Indeed, if we place ourselves into the hands of God, who reaches out with a heart full of love towards us, we will discover that God is able to create something beautiful out of the rubble. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Until we talk again next week, everybody, please be safe, please behave yourselves, and may God hold all of us in the palm of God's hands. Take care. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.